2 minutes late, but this meeting of the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee will come to order. And Representative Lemire will approve the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the minutes.
Very well. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Pass. Okay, now we're going to have a fun day today. We're going to talk about completely different issues. We have the cosmetology and labor and industry. And Commissioner Peterson, welcome to our committee. We're looking forward to having you impart all your wisdom, not all of it, but a fairly good sliver.
Mr. Chair, if you look for all my wisdom, this would be a very short meeting.
Did you see that?
You can start anytime you'd like. We have a quorum. We have a quorum, so we aren't going to pass any bills anyway, so we can just go for it.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you for asking us to stop by today. With me today is Cecilia Jackson, the Chief Financial Officer of the Department of Labor and Industry, and also John Rakowski, the Government Affairs Representative for the Department.
Welcome to our committee.
Many of you probably know John.
I do know him both.
And if you, during the session or during the interim, if you have questions or constituent issues you need answers to, please talk to John or talk to me. John's phone number is 651-284-5103. Mine is 651-284-5010. We'll get back to you as soon as we can on any issues that you have that come up. So we want to be as responsive as possible. And also with us there are appointed a deputy commissioner and two assistant commissioners. Only one of my assistant commissioners will be here today. She's Jessica Luman, who's back here. She's taking time off from her job today. She'll start with the department next Tuesday, the day after Martin Luther King Day. And the other commissioner who's not here is Judge Gary Hall with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and he'll be joining us next week too. As some of you may know, this is my second stint with the Department of Labor and Industry. I last held the position in 1988 to 1990. The department has changed since then, as you can well imagine. The legislature has given us new responsibilities. Some of the laws we implement have changed, and technology has dramatically changed. However, for my first week and a half on the job, I can tell you that one thing remains the same, and that the people at the department are very committed to serving our state, and they work very hard and very productive. And also I can tell you that the department has been well managed. One of my predecessors, Steve Spigum, former House Speaker, former representative from Purdue County, from Kenya. I'd like to base my presentation off a PowerPoint you have up there. As you will see, we'll provide just an overview of the work the department does. And even though it's not a budget, I realize we're not talking about a budget today, but we will have some budget information just because it helps make the department make more sense. And I also need to point out the numbers we're using the budget are all tentative until the governor presents his budget and you folks act on it. And so this is just the proposal we made based on the numbers we've had in the past.
Commissioner Peterson, is that the cockpit of the IRRRB plane?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is just one of many planes. This is one of the faster ones, according to Commissioner Sertit. What did he do? You told me, Dan told me how to start, and I've already forgotten. No? That's all right. What are you doing? I'm sorry. No. And it's also, before we start, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to invite members to ask questions as we go along. At any time you have a question or points you want to make, please bring them up. And also, if you have questions that I don't know the answers to, I've only been on the job for 8 days, the people here can't answer. We'll get back to you as soon as we possibly can. And so I apologize for not being able to know everything you may need to know.
But Chairman, Commissioner Peterson, I just want you to know you're one of the few commissioners we have that would represent this division. So you were chose because we didn't have a lot of other choices. We appreciate you being here.
You sure you don't want to make another choice?
We're very happy with the choice we have. But we don't know what we're going to do next week.
The department is located on Lafayette Road, down when you cross the Lafayette Bridge, near the intersection of 7th Street and Lafayette. It's down near, those you may know, the DNR building and the PCA building. It's down that same neighborhood. The department's been there for about 23, 24 years. It's in the, I used to call it the Space Center Complex. I don't know if it's still called that or not. This is the department's mission, to ensure Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. And our vision is to be a trusted resource, and impartial regulator for employees, employers, and property owners. Governor Dayton, or at that time Governor-elect Dayton, hired me, he asked me to do whatever we could do to keep good jobs in Minnesota. He asked that to be one of, although that's, I'm not an economic development agency, the department is not, he asked us to do whatever we could do to help keep track good jobs in Minnesota and keep good ones here. And so with that, I assured him that I intend to do just that, but nevertheless, with that framework in mind, my own philosophy is that with the department, is that as we go through it, is to ask our people to always follow the law, comply with the law, do the best you can to follow the law, and also that we treat the people we deal with, the citizens of Minnesota, the businesses of Minnesota, or anybody else, we treat them fairly and decently, and we always hear their side, whether it's a building owner, injured worker, insurance company, or whomever it is, we treat them fairly and decently. And internally, I want the department employees to work hard, be as efficient as possible, and I'd like each one to feel that they have a good, fulfilling job, and that they can go home every night feeling happy and proud of their work at the state of Minnesota Department of Labor Industry. And I hope that we can serve you in that sense. The stuff we do, the agency activities are designed to ensure that workplaces are free from injury and illness, buildings are safe, healthy for those who occupy them. Workers injured on the job are provided treatment and benefits required by law. That's, of course, the whole workers' comp division. Workers from all communities have the opportunity to develop critical skills through apprenticeship training. We'll talk later on about the apprenticeship division. Workers who construct and inspect buildings are qualified to perform their work. Workers, potential workers, and employers have a clear understanding of the rights and responsibilities in the workplace. This applies to workers' comp section, to occupational safety and health, as well as some other places. And that this is a really important one. Minnesotans, every one of them, have access to reliable resources to help them understand and comply with our laws and regulations that we administer and enforce. Governor Dayton has made it very clear, I think, in his public statements, and certainly to me, that he wants the government to be as, for our agencies, to be as transparent as possible, to be as open as possible, so people can figure out exactly what we're doing, and hopefully, at least for the most part, figure out why we're doing it. And so we'll try to do the best we can in pursuit of that that idea. The core function of the agency, we administer laws related to employment, workplace laws, you know, minimum wage, child labor, stuff like that, apprenticeship, workplace safety, that's occupational safety and health, OSHA, workers' compensation, and construction of buildings. As we look at everything, John said this to me, we look at everything from what's inside, it's behind the walls, or inside the walls and under the street. Our inspectors look at those sorts of things. Going along, we provide training, outreach, and other resources to our customers, promulgate construction codes, very important thing what we do, conduct plan reviews, inspections, audits, and investigations, review workers' comp claims, and oversee the provision of benefits. Make sure that an injured worker, if she is entitled to something, they get it as quickly as possible. Provide informal dispute resolution services, provide bulk rehab services, issue penalties for violation of the law, issue professional license and certifications. We have, over a two-year period, over a biennium, we issue something like 110,000 licenses. So licenses are a big part of our business, and that we register apprenticeship programs. This is just a chart, organizational chart of the department, as you can see, is the commissioner, deputy commissioner. Then the safety and workers' compensation division includes both the workers' compensation aspects as well as OSHA, or OSHA compliance and workplace safety. I won't go into the details of those, but the deputy commissioner, or then the other side, the construction codes and labor standards, that's all the various, the electrical board, the plumbing board, high pressure piping board, and others are part of that agency. And the divisions there are administrative services, code plan reviews, code inspections, apprenticeship and labor standards. And then we have kind of overhead stuff involved under the deputy commissioner with financial services, legal stuff, John, communications, computer operations stuff. We got a big budget, but it's a deceptive budget in terms of the number of people we have working there. But I'll describe that more as we go through this. But you can look at the pie chart that you can see the workers' compensation fund. This should not be expenditures by fund. Excuse me. This is revenues by fund. There was an error. And that person, of course, lost his job then. Kidding. It's revenues by fund, $259,000. The workers' comp is accounts for 73%, $189 million. The next biggest chunk of money is the construction code area, which is $43 million. Then special revenues accounts are 5%, $12 million. The federal government provides, this is basically through the OSHA programs, provides $10 million. And then the general fund, we get $1.7 million. That just basically goes to the labor standards division. And the other funds which we get are from, we get money from the workforce development fund and the Department of Energy and Economic Development. We get about $2 million from there. So as you can see, we have very few general funds, or comparatively small. This is just, the reason I put this in here is to show that how much of our operation comes from, is actually devoted to the operations department, how much the benefits that go out to people. You can see this is just for next year's projected appropriations. And it's not the biennium, which the other numbers will be. You can see under the agency total, 27% of our budget goes to our salary, fringes, that sort of thing. And that's $35 million. And that's, we have 431 employees in the department. Then for operations, this is the biggest chunk here is for rent, but also for mileage.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry to interrupt, sure. Commissioner Peterson. I think that's the first time I've got to call you that. On your salaries at 27%, how much of that is state-funded salaries versus federal or fee-driven salary? If you don't have that at hand, maybe at some point, could you get that to us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, when you say state-funded, that's general fund-funded, is that mm-hmm. about 12%? No, 12 positions.
Thank you.
No, that's just basically in the labor standards division, which is the looks at minimum wage, child labor laws, that sort of thing. Wage and hours, 40 hours, that sort of thing. So there aren't very many positions that actually come out of the general fund. And then, so operations, or salary and operations, are 30% of our budget. 70% of budget is what I'm just terming for explanation purposes, are external. The single biggest chunk is the second item down there, is benefit claims for injured workers. And that's $70 million. And I'll discuss that in more detail later, what that's all about. We have a grant to the Vinland Center for Rehabilitation in Loretto that we, $200,000 a year. Then we also pay for some operations with other state agencies. The Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, which is a 5-member court, we pay $1.7 million to them. The Office of Administrative Hearings, which has a number of work comp judges, we pay $7.2 million to them. We pay $751,000 to the Department of Commerce for their fraud investigations. And then for Minnesota Management Budget, because they get to run everything, they get $100,000. Then
Representative House, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real quickly, you mentioned a few sentences ago that some of the cost was rental of buildings. Could you give the chair a breakdown of buildings that you own and occupy versus buildings that you rent and who you rent them from?
Mr. Chair.
You want to give your name for the record?
Cecilia Jackson, Chief Financial Officer, Labor and Industry. The total rent cost for the Department of Labor and Industry is $1.9 million, and we have our main building at 443 Lafayette. We have a building that we rent all of our buildings. We don't own any of our space.
We have
buildings up in St. Cloud, Duluth, Mankato. And I say buildings, it's really small office space.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up.
Somehow.
Does it appear to the agency or other agencies when they rent that it's more economical than owning the building?
I'm not sure. The Department of Administration manages all of the building sites, and as they're putting together their leases, they do a cost-benefit analysis. And I have not taken a look at that information. I can get that for you if you like.
Mr. Chairman, that might be something this committee might want to look at. I know up in Walker, there was a brand new building put up so the Department of Corrections could open a probation office, and they were in a building in Walker that was a very adequate building, but they moved to a brand new one, and they're renting that at an astronomical fee.
I'm sure we'll be able to get the right information for us to make decisions.
Thank you.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, I just had a question on, it would seem like Commerce Department has the duty to do the fraud investigation. Why are you paying them, or am I missing something?
That's funds that come out of the, there's a fraud investigation for the workers' compensation. And so that's, okay. And so hence, it comes out of the premium dollar, the assessments made against the workers' comp premium dollar. I'll explain the whole assessment thing in a
later. I didn't realize it was in work comp.
Yeah,
work okay.
Comp. That's our only relationship. Under just going down the list, workplace safety consultation, we have safety grants that we take out of our penalties that amount to almost $1 million, $998,000. Then the loggers rebates. It's a program that I'm proud to say was set up when I was commissioner last time, that the loggers themselves pay into a fund and we send it back for training purposes to keep down workers' comp rates for logging. As you can imagine, logging can be a very dangerous, injury-prone area. So we try to set up a way to bring down their costs. And it's working pretty well, I understand.
It's my understanding it's working very, very well, and it's paying big dividends, and I'm glad it's being done.
Then under construction codes and licensing, we have a contract recovery fund for $3.3 million. That's for the assessment against the licensed contractors for when an individual homeowner gets a bad deal from a contractor. So there's some reimbursement. They bring an estimate of claims and try to work something out for them. The other entry is under most of our electrical inspections are done through contract inspections. We have, maybe 5 or 10 on staff, but most of our inspections for electricity are done through contract inspectors scattered throughout the state. And so as you can imagine, there are advantages and disadvantages to that. But it has always been the practice of the electrical board, that's the practice. So the advantage is that when there's less construction, less activity, the costs of the department go down because we don't have to pay them regular salaries. It's a good system particularly for the electrical board because we have there are so many inspections done. So much of our work is done for the electrical board, and they're also scattered throughout the state. So you don't have to send people from traveling. So the system has worked pretty well, I think, over time. Under labor standards,
Representative Mulry,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, and I wasn't on this committee the last few years. I can't remember, but there was some rating of some of these kind of like trust funds, and this is what you're actually paying out. Is there anything in like that the general fund owes any of these funds back or something like that, or
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, yes. There's a, under a law passed in 2007, $1.5 million was taken out of the construction code fund, and starting in 2008, for fiscal FY 2008, was dedicated to the general fund. So the $1.5 million came out of construction code license fees of the general debt fund and dedicated to the general fund. So in other words, that you're paying your, if you're an electrician, or you're paying your electrician, you're buying a license, a small part of that fee will be going into the general fund. It's not necessarily, we try, we think we're succeeding, at least my understanding we're succeeding pretty well, try to keep the cost of licenses, inspections, registrations, all that stuff, try to keep it at cost. Whatever our costs are, that's what we charge back. In this case, that $1.5 million is not part of our cost. It's just part of the general fund.
Mr. Chair, was there any duty to pay that back sometime? Or
the law does not call for a payback or a clawback or whatever phrase you want to use.
So it was just rated.
Okay. At my memory tells me there was quite a substantial surplus in that fund, and the anticipated withdrawals from that fund did not meet the surplus. So because we were in deficit originally when we took it, we took that to balance the budget to pay for something else. And I can't remember the other thing, but I'm sure it's something you wanted.
Mr. Chairman, probably wasn't something I wanted, but I understand what was done, but I just thought we probably sometime should look at paying it back.
I think it was taken with the promise that if it was needed, we would make sure it did get paid back. Since I was a party to that action, okay. I remember it very well, and it was an open running wound for a while.
Mr. Chairman, if you were party to it, I want to emphasize that it probably was a very wise move, though.
And Mr. Chair, if I could tell the commissioner that I fought him tooth and nail, so I guess it wasn't a wise move on my part.
The next...
It's amazing what happens when you have different governors.
The next is one more cut at the budget, trying to explain some of our budgetary stuff. The workers' compensation fund provides special benefits and services authorized under the workers' compensation law. The biggest payment over a 2-year period would be $100 million for supplementary benefits. Supplementary benefits were a part of the work comp law until 1995, and the goal was to allow a permanently injured worker to receive up to 65% of the average weekly wage. That was repealed in 1995. However, as you can well imagine, there are a number of injured workers who are still entitled to benefits because of their injuries prior to 1995. So this is a number that is still high, but over time it will decrease. Till sometime 2040 or 2050, it'll just go away. But right now, it's still a substantial number. And the second injury benefits was another program for employers who had employees who were injured, who had a previous prior injury and who were hurt at their new job. And that was repealed in 1992. And then we still have liabilities for payments due over the next 2 years around $21 million. So those are the two single biggest aspects of the workers' compensation fund. Then going down, the workers' compensation benefits paid to employees of uninsured, bankrupt, self-insured employers. As you can well imagine, there are some employers that just don't take up workers' compensation insurance. Or they go bankrupt and they can't pay it. And so there is an assessment made against everybody, made against all other payers to pick up the slack those injured workers. Get their workers' compensation. That amounts to $19.6 million. Then we have the cost of administering the whole program and a portion of the occupational safety and health program for the labor industry. And over a 2-year period, that's $48 million. And the cost of the workers' compensation activities at the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Workers' Compensation Board of Appeals, Department of Commerce, and the Minnesota Management Budget. That's the same stuff we just talked about a minute ago. So that's where that money goes. And then another little pie chart. The expenditures by program. This is another way of saying what we just, well, this is by the whole department. But the workers' compensation benefits that we go out account for 54% of the expenditures of the department. That's the stuff in red. The next single biggest chunk is the construction codes administration, and that's 19% of the program, and that's $50 million. As we'll talk about later, we got about 100 and some employees in that area. Then administering the workers' comp programs, $45 million. The general support, $18 million. Labor standards and apprenticeship, $4 million, less than 2% of the overall operation of the department. As I said earlier, the department is divided into two big divisions, the construction code licensing and the safety and workers' compensation. This combines both the whole division, both OSHA and as well as workers' comp. The workers' compensation section is 121 employees, and they help employees injured on the job receive proper medical equipment and benefit payments in a timely manner. So if you're hurt and you're not getting paid and your employer has agreed that it was an injury, an on-the-job injury, you're entitled to get paid to get your benefits right away. And so what we often end up doing, an injured worker doesn't get benefits, may call our office and say, I'm not getting paid. What's happening? Why is the insurance company, 40 months, then our job is to contact insurance company, find out what's happening, and try to ensure that injured worker gets her or his money as soon as they're entitled to it. And if they don't, the insurance company for what is not contesting it, but simply is delaying, then it can be subject to fines or penalties. However, for those of you who have dealt with workers' comp, I know there's a number of small business owners on this committee, so you may have dealt with it. If you don't agree that there's a legitimate on-the-job injury, then you just contest it. The first report of injury is filed, you just contest it, and then you go into the system, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But that's what we do. And then we issue penalties and review records to ensure the state laws are followed. We have four sections. I'm not going into details what each one of these sections does, but claims, service investigations, basically they're the ones that follow up on cases. Benefit management and dispute resolution, there is a dispute that runs through that section. Data management, we do a lot of imaging. You can imagine, we have files going back 50 years. And so there's just a lot of files and data that has to be kept. And so that's a data heavy section. Invoke rehab. The department provides some vocational rehabilitation itself. We have a small vocational rehabilitation unit for certain people that we cover, but we also regulate the activities of qualified rehabilitation consultants, QRCs, regulate their activities. So that this area, that's both of those. Any questions on the workers' comp area at all? The two biggest issues we have that in workers' comp that I'm not sure we'll be bringing anything to you this year or not. We're trying to figure it out. First of all, we have a worker, for those of you who've been in legislature, you know, you're probably aware of this, but those who are new members, we have, due to the intensity of discussions over workers' compensation battles in the past, the legislature in 1995 set up a workers' compensation advisory commission. And it's composed of members from labor and management. And the two co-chairs are the head of the AFL-CIO and the head of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And the idea behind it is that before workers' comp bills are brought to the legislature, that committee agree on it. So that way you keep the fights out of the legislature and let them fight it out. The workers' compensation was basically an agreement between labor and management going back to 1930. At that time, what the two sides agreed to do is that labor would give up the right to sue in regular court, and in turn, business agreed to provide regular insurance for all its workers. And so you kept it out of the courts, and we have a parallel system, but we kept it out of the courts, and which was what labor gave up, the chance to get bigger recovery, and business in turn promised to insure everybody. So that every employed worker in the state was covered by workers' compensation insurance. So everybody got covered. Well, some people, under that agreement, some people probably got a lot less than they would have, but some people probably got more than they would have. And so it's an ancient agreement. That, but you go back, if you go back to history, so it makes sense. We had this advisory committee chaired by labor and management, and they come up with agreements. So instead of them bringing their battles to you, they'll come to an agreement. I can tell you that when I was commissioner last time, Lowell, so many years ago, before most members of the committee were born, that it was a terrible, there were terrible battles. It was just ugly. That it wasn't good for anybody. That because of just the intensity of feelings on both the sides of labor and management. And so I think the system has worked out well. I know that both sides complain occasionally, but
yes, Chair.
I think it's worked out well.
Representative Paymar.
Commissioner, can you just, I'm just curious about this parallel system. So if someone makes a workers' comp claim and it then goes, what, to the Office of Administrative Hearings, is that the parallel system rather than going into the court system? And if, well, I'll just ask you, that's the process?
That's generally the process. That if we can mediate it at the department, we try to mediate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if someone disagrees with a ruling made by the administrative hearings judge, what appeal process is there then?
Representative Pam, Mr. Chairman, thanks for asking. It's a good question. I should have fulfilled you on that. What happens if you disagree with the ruling made at the Office of Administrative Hearing, you appeal to the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, a five-member court. So you don't go to the regular Court of Appeals. You just simply go to the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals. That's composed of members who are expert in the field, who know workers' comp law, and are able to deliver decisions relatively quickly. Then, if you lose at that level, you can appeal to the state Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair, I was under the impression that if you appeal, that it would go back to the very judge who denied you in the first place. But you're saying it goes directly to this appeals court. Yes. So, okay.
No, it's like in any court, that court may at certain times refer it back to the original judge with ask for more information, for more facts that they may not have been on the record. They may do that. But for the most part, the Court of Appeals makes a decision.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stensrud.
Oh, thank you, Chairman. Commissioner, I was just for background or clarification for my understanding, you talked about supplemental benefits, and it's like $100 million for one fiscal year?
Two.
Okay.
It's $50 million a year.
And is that... I was just curious, number of people who are receiving benefits and what kind of benefits is that? Is that like a salary that's being replaced, or is it medical payments?
It's called indemnity payments. Basically, it's non-medical. The supplemental benefits are not medical payments; they're indemnity payments. And the idea that we've done away with supplemental benefits as of 1995.
Right.
But the idea behind it was that the injured, a permanently injured worker would get 60, up to 65%, not up to, but 65% of the average. And it turned out, it may have been a good idea, but I think the legislature in 1995 thought that it was just costing too much. And so they gave it up. But at the same time, the workers who are already injured were entitled to it, because that's, they're injured under that law. So that's why that's a number that will keep going down, but it's still pretty high.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, and the total number of people receiving those benefits for $100 million.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stensrud, we'll get the numbers to you. Okay. I don't know. We'll find out.
Thank you.
Any other questions? So one thing we want to do in the dispute resolution area is to speed it up. The governor asked me, said, I want you, when you go down that department, I want you to treat people fairly. I want you to do whatever you can do to make sure that people, both sides, employers and employees, get their issues resolved quick. So I'm working with both labor and management trying to figure out ways, if there are ways, we can speed it up. We're not sure whether it'll be successful, that's what we'll try. So we may be bringing a bill to you in a month or so on that issue. The other big issue we have to deal with, and this is it's a more complex and a tougher one, and I don't know if we'll ever get to it, but that's medical costs. When I was, it's the same cost we deal with the rest of society. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. But when I was commissioner last time, 40% of the total cost of the premiums went to medical costs. Today, 20 years later, 60% of your total premium dollars go for medical costs. And so basically it switched around. The indemnity, which are the cash payments, were 60% 20 years ago. Now they're 40%. And your medical costs were 40%. Now they're 60%. And it's going up rapidly. And like medical costs everywhere are going up. And so we're trying to figure out a way of solving that. But you can imagine the problems that those medical providers want the money. They need it. They're providing probably higher quality, better services. It's costing them more. Same time, the employers of the state are paying more than they should be. And one of the problems with workers' comp, there is a subsidy that goes on because of the lower cost of areas like Medicare. As you all know, Medicare pays less than cost, or pays less. And so there's I don't want to go into real costs, but but workers' comp ends up paying more for the same procedure. So consequently, there's a subsidy that goes on between the workers' comp section of money to Medicare and to other lower-priced areas. So it's a problem. And I'm not quite sure how you get your hands around it. Workers' comp is not a huge thing for the hospitals or providers, but it's 3 to 4 to 5%. So it's something. And it's hard for them to relinquish those dollars. And I'm sympathetic to them, but at the same time, I'm sympathetic to the needs of employers and others in the state.
It's my understanding that insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield get about 58% of what's usual and customary, and work comp pays 85% of what's usual and customary. And they don't want to relinquish that. I know that for a fact.
I'm not sure about the precise figure, but it's 85% for work comp, and it would vary, of course, with the insurance mm-hmm. companies. But yes, you're in the ballpark, Mr. Chairman. Any other questions?
I think Mulroy's surprised that I had it right.
Mr. Chairman, just like the clock is right, you know, one two thing. Times a day, you're right two times every year. He'll get me, don't worry.
If there are no other questions or points on workers' comp, move to OSHA compliance. This is also funded out of, just going back a bit, I forgot I'll send this thing back, but one thing I want to point out with the workers' comp division, workers' comp claims have dropped somewhat in the last 5 or 6 years, somewhere in the 20-25% area. One thing that the department, as an example, I think why the department has been well managed, the department has also decreased its number of employees in workers' comp about the same number. So as claims have dropped, we've decreased the number of employees. I think that shows it's a sign of good management, responsible management for employers and others who are paying into the work comp system. But OSHA compliance, how do I get back? Dan, where are you? How do I get back? The back arrow? Yeah, I got it. OSHA compliance, occupational safety and health compliance, is also funded out of workers' comp. We have 85 employees, and they enforce the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Act and standards that ensure safe and healthy working conditions for Minnesota workers through on-site inspections, issuing citations for noncompliance, interpreting standards, and helping employers understand how to comply with these standards. Minnesota OSHA revises and adopts newer existing OSHA regulations in response to employee complaints of workplace hazards and discrimination due to safety and health issues. Minnesota has a partnership with the federal government. We pay 50% of our OSHA funds for compliance, and the federal government pays 50%. This has allowed us to run our own program, to set our own standards, such as Representative Clark a number of years ago passed the Right to Know Bill. And so we're the first in the country, maybe the only one in the country, for all I know, that has this bill. And we've had other, good programs that we may be able to do here on the state level that we may not have had on the federal level. So we think it's worked pretty well. I don't know if there are any questions about Von OSHA.
Representative Mahoney.
Commissioner Peterson, I asked a while back if you'd ever understood what the term bloody pockets meant. Did you ever find out what that meant?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, no. It just struck me that someone's got some blood in their pocket.
Yep. Mr.
Commissioner, just so you know, as someone who's gone through the workers' comp from the working stiff's side, oftentimes you have to go through, you have to report to the foreman, you have to go to the company nurse, you have to fill out multiple pages of paperwork. You then have to sit down with the nurse, the safety prevention officer, or the safety officer, the safety prevention officer, and then you're called in a couple other times, quite often. What bloody pockets means is when somebody steps into one of the satellites, wraps toilet paper around their hand, and puts duct tape over the toilet paper so it doesn't move, puts a glove back on, and goes back to work. What I'm trying to tell you is that there's an awful lot of paperwork in OSHA. An awful lot of paperwork in OSHA. And an awful lot of reason for a working person to not report it, get off work, go to their own doctor, and have their own doctor take care of it, and then the health care system comes into it, rather than getting charged to the OSHA, the workplace, I don't know, I think it's the rate and their insurance. So it's been a problem for many, many years. It just continues to get worse because companies have figured out a way to annoy working people enough that they just start making the blood flow into their pocket rather than onto the company's balance sheets.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would hope that no one has to go through that. I prefer that every employer take responsibility for activities that occur in their workplace and deal with it. Sorry that has to happen. Hopefully, if we can, through education, we can stop that from happening. I understand there would be incentives for companies and for individual workers afraid of any retaliation. I'd hope it wouldn't occur.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question that I've asked, I think, of every commissioner, and that when we've had people from your department before us, and it's different perspectives on it. But what's happened over the years that I still hear about is that whenever there's going to be an OSHA inspection, the workers there have told me, some of the people I know, that they're alerted ahead of time. And we had some discussion with the commissioners in the past and the folks working in the ocean, and they always deny it, that or they wonder about it, and then they find out, no, they can't really find a source for that kind of leak to the company. But I would just ask you to keep it in mind and maybe begin a discussion with the current people in OSHA, and just know that as far as I know, it's still happening. Might be worth checking out to see if it does happen or not. I think there was recently a public story about that on the radio. I can't remember which place it was. But it is a problem because OSHA can be very effective, but if the workers are told to clean everything up before the OSHA inspector gets there, then you don't really get the true picture, and people are suffering with some of those issues. So I'll just ask you to look into that or continue to be aware of it as a concern.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, if we find anybody that's doing that, anybody who works for OSHA that's advising somebody in advance that there's going to be an OSHA inspection, disciplinary action will be taken against her, and I'll look into this.
Thank you. Representative Mallory, and could you keep it short? We need to keep this moving.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess quickly, as you used to be in the AG's office, and Representative Mahoney brought up an issue. I also hear it a little bit on local FELA cases. Do you think, I realize there's no constitutional right, but should there be anything that we should look into as far as how much information the injured employee has to give to the, in other words, they may be giving up all of their case under, if they're pressured into telling the employer's employees. or talking to them. Is there anything that, any restrictions at all on how much they are required to do that or not?
Madam Chair, President Mulray, I don't know. I'm not familiar with it. I'd like to, I'll spend the time looking into it. Okay. Thanks for asking. I'm just not sure.
Thank you, Commissioner. If you could continue with your presentation.
Compliance, I think we've covered that. Consultation, workplace safety consultation is a smaller division, it's got 16 members. Basically, we work in partnership with businesses to provide them advice on how to strengthen their prevent accidents on the work site. This is an area that's it's completely separate from OSHA compliance, so they go out to a work site and explain to people what they need to do to make the workplace more safety, more safe. However, they, unless there's some imminent hazards, they will not report them to OSHA at the plant or at the in the site. And so they work apart, and it's been a pretty successful program. It's paid. One of the good things about it is 90% paid for by the federal government, 10% paid for out of the workers' comp people. So it seems to work pretty well. And we have a list of different partnerships we've entered into. They're down here. I don't need to go into that. You can read that if you want to read it. But we've had real dramatic decrease in injuries at some of these major construction sites as well as some of the general industry partnerships. We think it's been pretty successful. This is just the Safety and Workers' Compensation Division number. I realize that, Madam Chairman, you want us to move ahead, so I'll just pass over this. Mm-hmm. Construction codes and licensing. This in 2005, in order to have a one-stop shop for all construction licensing activities on the state level, five different boards and activities were brought under the umbrella of the Department of Labor and Industry, and those boards were the electrical board, the plumbing board, the high-pressure piping board, the construction code bill board, and one other one. Residential contractors, residential building contractors. We're all brought under the umbrella of the Department of Labor and Industry, and that's where we've developed our the Division of Construction Codes and Licensing. And you can see we advise the public and enforce the laws related to the regulations regarding construction codes and licensing in the construction industry. The single biggest one, as I said earlier, are electrical inspections, but also plumbing inspections, residential building contractors, plumbing, high pressure boilers, high pressure piping, boats for hire. These are like most of them are the larger lakes in northern Minnesota. People go out; we inspect those boats where. 10 or 15 fisher anglers on a boat, and we inspect those boats, make sure they're safe, and then independent contract certification. And so we do this through licensing and certification enforcement, review the plans. What we do is review the plans for new public buildings and publicly licensed buildings to make sure that they're going to be structurally sound and electrically sound and that sort of thing. And then we do inspections, code development. We have 28 different sets of rules. As you can imagine, the building codes and other codes they're always changing. Technology changes, views of what works, what doesn't work change. So these are constantly being reviewed. A lot of work is done through advisory committees. Then we also do education. We certify continuing education for in this various area.
I have a question. I've had people come forward and ask me about the licensing, and you know, most of these trades have licenses that are state issued. Is it a duplication for cities to require that they be licensed in their city too? I mean, many times a contractor has to be licensed in this city and that city and everything else. Is that a duplication, or do they have different codes that they need to go by?
Madam Chairman, I don't know.
You stumped us. We'll have to get back.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That's something I should know. I should have asked. Should have been the first question I asked. It's a very good question.
I just know that when we built our building, some of our contractors commented about they have a state license, mm-hmm. and then they had to go through the city to get a license too, and then you know, if so.
But that's a good question. I'll find out.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Mulray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know exactly how much it gets into that, but I know there are laws specifically on that issue of what the local can do, what types of things, and what others can do.
Thank you.
But as to the specifics, I don't know.
Thank you.
We'll get to specifics. Thanks for asking. Labor standards is another division, and this is we produce outreach and education, employers and employees, about complying with labor and employment laws, minimum wage, overtime, child labor laws, prevailing wage, parental leave laws, and employee rights regarding termination of employment, and wages due. And we receive 185 calls a day. That the whole unit receives, actually it says 42,500. We've actually checked that number. It's actually 24,500.
Oh.
But we get a lot of calls. That's the point. We do get a lot of calls. And so a lot of the work of the people in that department or that section are just basically responding to the complaints, inquiries, that sort of thing. We also provide outreach and education about Minnesota labor laws for businesses, professional groups, schools, community-based organizations, and others. We've created 13 documents in 13 different languages. And you can read the list of languages, including Arabic, Cambodian, Hmong, Spanish, some of the other ones that we've looked at. And this is the stuff that really affects people on a very basic level, just about sort of their rights in the workplace. And so it's a very important thing that the state provides, although it's very small. Apprenticeship is another division. We have six and a half employees, and we supervise, regulate an apprenticeship program. So what happens, you register an apprenticeship program. We have about 300 of them registered in the state of Minnesota, and around 7,000 or 8,000 workers involved with it. And we go out and make sure that they're actually providing the training that they should be, and they're really not hiring people as apprentices as a way of dodging, trying to keep wages lower than they should be. And we also spend a lot of time going to schools, vocational, to high schools, and as well as community colleges and business and industry groups, talking about program requirements, selection criteria, and general information. 600 visits annually, sponsors, employers, and promotional sponsors. You know, this apprenticeship program is one of these things that I think that the society, I mean, we haven't done a very good job on. Germany has a really great system of apprenticeship programs. It's been very successful. And for whatever reason, the United States, and it's not Minnesota, but it's nationwide, we've never taken advantage of this apprenticeship program, which is a really good way of learning about stuff. And too often it's just been restricted to union environments that we don't need to be. Apprenticeship programs can be very successful, and I wish there was a way we could expand it. I'm not sure how, but I know it's a very good way of learning. You talk to people like Reverend Mahoney, went through an apprenticeship program, and it's a great way of learning. Learning a skill, learning a trade, and I wish we could do more.
You haven't talked to the guy they've worked with lately.
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guenther.
Thank you.
Chair
Mr. Commissioner, can a person be in an apprenticeship program without being in the union?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, there are a number of apprenticeship programs that have nothing to do with union. But too often we think that they're sort of a union deal. They're not. The unions often encourage them, but that doesn't mean they have to be a union deal.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And
no,
this is the general support division. This is more budget stuff we can talk about later. I think these are the last page does have our address. Of all of our St. Paul office, the Mankato, St. Cloud, Duluth offices, as well as my name and number, the deputy commissioner, assistant commissioners, as well as John's number. But other than that, Madam Chair, that completes my presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Does anybody have any more questions? Comments? No? Okay. Chair Guenther?
Yeah. Mr. Commissioner, it's been very delightful to have you here, and thank you for coming, and we look forward to working with you in the future. And right now I'm on the Work Comp Advisory Board. If I continue to stay there, I'll see you more often. And thank you for coming, and enjoyed you being here too, Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members.
And now, members, we'll have the Cosmetologist Examiners Board come forward and we'll hear all the wonderful things they're doing. Gina. Welcome to our committee. Would you give your name for the record and tell us all about the cosmetologist?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gina Stauss-Fass, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Cosmetology. Good afternoon. I thank you today for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners and its functions. I don't have any handouts except for the newsletter that's coming around right now. I was called late yesterday to testify, so I apologize if any I can get you something later on. So that is the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners statutory authority resides in Minnesota Chapter 155A, and the mission of the board is to is protecting the health and safety of the citizens and visitors of the state by licensing and inspecting the practice of cosmetology. The board's core mission is to constantly strive to serve and care for our licensees, our applicants, and the public by being committed to public protection, superior service, excellence, and continuous improvement. The board believes that leading with a vision and making sound decisions will result in quality outcomes and successful operations. The board members itself is comprised of four members appointed by the governor. Three of them are licensed in the field of cosmetology, and one is a public member. They're appointed for four-year terms. The board meets approximately 5 to 6 times a year, and those are public meetings. The board also has a complaint committee division of it, which two members sit on. And what that committee does is it reviews formal complaints received by the board regarding licensed or unlicensed individuals and their practice. And that committee meets approximately 5 to 6 times a year. The board is housed in Minneapolis with 18 health licensing boards. We're considered a non-health licensing board, but we share a building with 18 other health boards, and all 18 boards share a central administrative unit that helps us with our finance, our payroll, and operations. And our board employs 13.8 employees, and we have our board is broken down into four divisions, which is a licensing division, a compliance division, an inspection division, and an administrative division. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit about each division. The licensing division is responsible for the verification of credentials and to ensure each applicant has met the requisite education and competence required to practice cosmetology or operate a cosmetology salon or school. The division is responsible to manage over the 42,000 licensees that the board regulates, as well as they license approximately 3,500 new licensees each year, as well as renewing 12,000 licenses a year. Who do we license? The board has over 14 different license types, such as operators, managers, instructors. Those would be personal licenses, which we have over 35,000 individuals. We have over 5,000 salon licenses and 51 school licenses. The board receives approximately 90,000 phone calls per year and over 7,500 emails per year that this division is primarily responsible for managing. This licenses are issued and renewed for a three-year period. So when we only renew 12,000 a year, it's because only one-third of our licensing population is up for renewal. This division has one manager and four licensing specialists. The compliance division is responsible to investigate complaints and take action against cosmetologists, salons, or schools that violate laws and rules the board is empowered to enforce. We investigate and process approximately 125 complaints per year on licensed or unlicensed individuals. We have a shared divisional manager and 1.8 compliance specialists. The inspection division is responsible to inspect all licensed salons and schools in the state to ensure public safety is met and salons are demonstrating sanitation and disinfection practices as well as upholding practice standards. The inspection process is also an opportunity to ensure all practitioners and salons are currently licensed. Inspectors also educate licensees about laws, rules, and sanitation practices upon their inspection. Where are the salons? Well, 43% of the salons are in the metro area, with the rest of them being out of state. We inspect approximately 3,500 salons per year, and that breaks down to about roughly 6 to 8 salons per day per inspector. Currently, we have a shared division manager that oversees the compliance and inspection division, and we have 3 field inspectors. The last division is the administrative division, which is responsible to organize and manage all the other 3 divisions to work in harmony together to accomplish the goals and the statutory mission of protecting the health and safety of the public. Further, this division is responsible to develop strategies for future advancement and innovation. Lastly, this division oversees all the public board meetings, rulemaking, and general operations. And this includes myself, a customer service specialist, a part-time student worker, and a temporary staff person at the moment. The board's role in public protection is vast and wide, and some of the items that I'm going to list off for you are what the different areas do in our role of ensuring we protect the public. In the licensing area, we're verifying credentials to ensure licensees are meeting set standards for education, experience, and safety. We are not just cashing their check. Schools are accountable to curriculum, safety, training length, and ethics standards. The staff are trained to analyze applications to identify fraudulent submission of credentials and are the front lines to answering scope of practice inquiries, license verification questions, and industry information from the public and the licensees. In the compliance and inspection areas, inspectors not only inspect the facility, they also issue violations orders when public safety is at risk. Approximately 20% of the salons inspected are issued in order to comply. In serious public safety situations, inspections may result in formal enforcement action that can include civil penalties up to and including license revocation. Other areas, the public is normally unable to identify safety and sanitation issues that we are that our inspectors look at, such as the reuse of instruments, such as nail files, toe separators, and those nice flip-flops they give you when you finish a pedicure. Other things such as dirty implements, inspections reduces the spread of bacteria, fungus, and diseases. On the inspection, we verify that they're using hospital-grade disinfectants and they're not using Windex and Tylex to represent hospital-grade disinfection. It also prevents malpractice. Negligence in a cosmetology salon or incompetence can result in physical injuries, such as color treatments if it's applied improperly or you don't ask the right question. It ensures continuing education and continuous improvement, that the services they're performing are within the scope of practice. The public is able to submit complaints due to the cosmetology regulation and inspections, and it's also the prevention of unlicensed individuals practicing illegal. Inspections also are able to look at the use of illegal instruments. Another item that's really popular in salons is a razor blade to cut off dead skin from your feet. Well, that is not a part of our scope of practice. You have to be a podiatrist or a surgeon to actually do that. Salons with deficient inspection history will result in further inspections and discipline. And also, with the board adding 35,000 new licensees per year, that creates additional jobs and businesses in the state of Minnesota. The overview of the board's budget. The board receives a direct appropriation from the state's general fund to cover the costs to operate the board. The board's revenue is based on the collection of fees from cosmetology-related licenses. So we, as a board, deposit all of our funds into the state's general fund, and then the legislature appropriates it back to us. In 2011, our anticipated revenue is a little bit over $1.4 million, and our appropriation is just over $1 million. In 2012, our anticipated revenue goes up to $1.8 million, and our appropriation is at $1.4 million.
Representative Mulry has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see on the storefronts, like braiding or others, when it's nails, those both or either fall within your scope?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, when it's a nail salon, yes, that does fall under our scope and our inspection process. Hair braiding falls in our rules and our statutes, but the ability to, they are required to get a permit in order to braid hair, but we don't have the authority to go in and inspect them, so they're just required a registration. But to cut hair, to color hair, to do nail services, to perform like a facial, like, you know, a nice scrub on your face, that all falls under our regulation.
Thank you.
Thank you. And to finish on the budget, is that approximately 65% of our budget goes to salary and 35% is for operations. As I stated, as our current base budget for fiscal year 2011 is just over $1 million, and historically the board has been appropriated approximately 50% of its revenues to operate. The agency is growing and growing in numbers. In 2006, we roughly had 36,000 licensees, and in 2011, we're right at about 42,000, with the number ever growing. The number increases to grow, the number of licensees continues to grow at approximately 3,500 licensees per year, and we see no sign of decreased enrollment at our schools to indicate a change in this pattern. The number of those maintaining their license on the renewal process also continues to increase. Last year during our renewal season, we only lost 1% of our licensing population, which could lead to more people are staying in the industry or more people are not able to retire, thus keeping up their license. Another area that has grown dramatically is our complaint process and our collection of civil penalties. In 2007, we received 30 complaints, and these complaints are regarding licensees or unlicensed individuals, and there was no collection of fees. Last year, in fiscal year 2010, we had approximately 150 complaints with 28,000 collected in civil penalties, and to date, we have collected approximately 22,000 in civil penalties. The reason the number of complaints continues to rise, I feel, is due to the infrastructure that is now in place in the administrative offices, as well as the more the public and the licensees are aware that those compromising the professional standards will be held accountable, the more willing they are to submit a complaint. When a complaint fell on deaf ears, they weren't necessarily as willing to submit them, especially a lot of them come from industry people themselves. Our agency services also continues to grow. We have a fully functional website where all applications, forms, examination information, complaints, enforcement action, and newsletters are housed. We have a web-based back office licensing system. We have online license renewals. We have an online license lookup. We have our complaint process for the public and licensees has dramatically changed. Our inspections are completed on a live database through the internet to have all readily accessible information needed to complete an aspect of the inspection process. So when they're out in the field and someone's like, I don't have my license posted, but I promise I'm licensed, they can look right on their computer live to see if that person was licensed within the last 2 minutes. They shouldn't be working if they were just licensed in the last 2 minutes, but they have all of that information on them when they're out there. And examinations are now offered in English, Vietnamese, Spanish, and Korean. We had some recent legislation in 2010 that dramatically changed the operations of the board, and one of the major components was the legislation resulted in changing all of our licenses to expire throughout the year rather than at the end of the year, which has dramatically helped in creating a nice flow for our staff rather than trying to renew 12,000 people at the end of the year. We sent out all new licenses in November, so everybody is now changed, and January 31st is the first expiration date. We also had a 15 business day processing requirement. In this legislation, we added, there was an addition of an application fee to support additional staffing, and we were required to have a feedback email for the public and licensees. And the positive outcomes from that legislation is the licensees are really happy that they're not in the last part of the year, and it is spread out through the year. The average processing time for licensing is down to 8 business days. Our positive feedback email rate is over 80%. Inspections are completed more regularly. We have customer service training and monthly customer service tips that are provided by the staff. I wanted to address negative outcomes if there was at this time. I really don't feel that our office has had any negative outcomes from the last year's legislation. I'm just going to briefly touch on the 2011 budget change item. For fiscal year 2013, the board has asked for a one-time $200,000 appropriation to fund the electronic connection to link the existing board's web-based database to the Office of Enterprise Technology e-licensing system. The state law requires that the board and other agencies to connect to this OET system. If this was not a legislative requirement, the board would not be seeking funding for the change item this legislative session. However, if the board will be required to connect to e-licensing, we will be unable to connect to it without an appropriation.
Did you say you have that or you're seeking that?
We are seeking it. It's a change item for this year. It's a change item in this legislative session for fiscal year 2013, a one-time appropriation, as all the other 18 health boards that I work with are seeking the same. We have our system, and OET has theirs, and we have to connect the two in order to make it work. The board will be possibly seeking some other legislative that is non-financial, which is school expiration dates. I would like to get changed to match the salons and the individuals. We're looking at possibly changing the word manicurist to nail technician, as that is a more commonly used term. Looking at addressing a reciprocity issue in state law, possibly an advanced aesthetics license, and to have examinations cover both a practical and written exam. In conclusion, I feel that the board's current infrastructure generally meets the needs and expectations of our licensees and the public, and we have a well-run board. At this time, I do not foresee any need this legislative session to change by an increase or a decrease to the current base budget appropriation for the board. I am sensitive to the current budget forecast. However, the board's revenue is significantly higher than its current appropriation, and the licensees of the board deserve for their fees to be maintained within the Board of Cosmetology. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I thank you again for giving me this opportunity today, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
On this handout, you have enforcement action.
Yes.
Is this annual or monthly or?
That, or Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that was compiling everything from our previous newsletter, and the previous newsletter didn't have them all in there. So it was, that one would probably be a little bit more than annual.
Okay.
That and one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These add up to almost $55,000. So where does that money go?
That stays, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in the states, that stays for the state's general fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
I think the relationship with their fees and revenue they come in all goes to the general fund, and then we have an appropriation from the general fund to pay for what they do. Mm-hmm. And they are a positive contributor to the general fund. So they, and they always have been. I remember when they were in the Department of Commerce, they collected over $2 million in fees and had one inspector. It just didn't make sense to me. So we asked the barbers if we could do it because Governor Quay ended the cosmetology board, and the barbers said, fine, we will do it under certain circumstances, and consequently we now have a cosmetology board that sounds like they're doing a pretty good job.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murray.
Just a comment and a couple quick questions. You're very well prepared for just getting called yesterday, so thank you. You mentioned 90,000 phone calls. Did I hear that correctly? And what are they calling for?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes, that is true. There has been we get an enormous amount of calls. Anything from they want to confirm that we got their application in our office to things such as they want to file a complaint, and we help them through the complaint process. We're doing online renewals. A big part of our calls now, most of these individuals work behind the chair cutting hair, and they're not on a computer all day, so they might not be completely 100% comfortable, so they want us to walk them through it step by step, and we help them go through it. Our staff have handouts that say, okay, what screen are you at, and they're able to direct them to get them to finish the process. So it's really about anything under.
All right. Thank you. One more, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that how many inspectors do you have, and how often do people get inspected? If there's like 30-some thousand licensees out here, how often would they be inspected?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we currently have 3 full-time inspectors, and our goal is to inspect them at approximately every little less than every year and a half. Some of the small, like for instance, we're already back in the metro area from being there last winter. We tried, because 43% of our salons are in the metro, that's going to be where we spend a bulk of the time, and with all the inspectors living in the metro area, we have them inspect in the winter. So it's a little bit, our goal is a little bit like 1.3 months, or 14, 15 months.
Thank you.
Mr. Leininger.
Mr. Chairman. I have a question regarding the e-licensing system I just learned recently. The state is going through an upgrade in their enterprise-wide software, and I'm wondering, is that part of your requirement to link into the SWIFT system? I understand that's what it's called. Is that a requirement that all the licensing agencies will be linked to the SWIFT system? So I'm kind of curious if this is going to be a required expenditure.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, can I see if Ryan wants, do you want to address that? I don't want to interchange SWIFT versus e-licensing. My belief from administrative, it's separate, so I want Ryan, okay, it is, okay. So SWIFT is the statewide accounting system that all agencies, I believe everyone will be going to. Currently we have MAPS to collect the funds and create all the reports. E-licensing is a database that Office of Enterprise Technology is moving forward, that there's current legislative that all agencies are on a schedule to hook into this. So the best way to describe it, instead of a cosmetologist coming to our board website to renew, they would need to go to the Office of Enterprise Technology website to do the renewal. It's a duplication of some sort.
Makes no sense to me. Is it or is it not part of SWIFT?
No.
So no, it's a standalone system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Somebody else bring
up. I can't resist. Mr. Chair, this was the governor's initiative last year that was forced upon almost every agency and every licensing board as part of the end of session negotiations that were required. I want this. I'm coming around a little bit to it in the sense that, if we're gonna have better and simpler government systems and services, everyone's got to be able to go from the pipefitters board to the cosmetology board to the accountancy board and understand it's all got to be the same, and that's what they're doing. Mm.
Thank what you. You wanted to say?
Yeah, Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Baumtrag, and I'm from Minnesota Management and Budget. And they are two separate initiatives. One is to update, SWIFT is to update MAPS. It's a new accounting system, financial planning for agencies. And it's a completely separate initiative than OET's e-licensing. So they're separate systems, separate purposes. E-licensing through OET is to have a one-stop electronic licensing system for all of your state agencies' licenses, from health department, labor and industry, cosmetology board, architectural engineering board. It's supposed to be a one-stop shop for licenses. So two separate state initiatives.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question, one from your report here. I noticed under the enforcement actions under civil penalty violation, it looks like there were four manicurists who had testing incident violation. What is the testing incident violation? And they also appear to be, it's pretty serious penalty of 6 months suspension in addition to a fine.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, a testing incident comes to us from our third-party vendor. Things such as they'll catch them with writing on their hand, typical what you think in, answers stuffed up their sleeve, and they catch them on the videotape, or they catch them where they walk out of the exam, go to their car, and come back, which is a breach of the security and what they agree to when they come into the testing facility. So it's a breach of...
Well, I just noticed that they all appear to be like Vietnamese names, and I'm just wondering, was there anything there with the language barrier, or is it? I mean, can you tell us what the violation was? It just seems pretty serious.
I can. Well, all four, Mr. Chairman, all and members of the committee, all four of these are public, and I have to go through each one to, and I could get that to you. One of the avenues that the testing company was going to do is not only have the, when you come in to sign off on what you're required to do, like you can go on a bathroom break, but you can't go out to your car, they were going to be writing that in English, that's in English and Vietnamese, but the candidates are signing off to the understanding that they're not to cheat, when they come in, and what the rules are. Or sometimes two people are sitting next to each other and they'll start talking and communicating about the test. So there's testing incidents.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't need to have that conversation here, but I would be really interested to hear what it is, since language barriers have been one of the major issues that we've had with this agency in terms of the exams. Was there something to do with that would be my question, so if you could just help me understand what that was. Then I have a different, kind of unrelated question, although it might affect the same group of persons. Recently, I've talked to numerous people who have been in salons where they have real difficulty with the air quality because of the products that are being used in terms of nails and so on, manicures. They may not be in there for that purpose, but they're dealing with having a hard time breathing in some cases. What do we have as standards for the air quality in our salons these days, especially given that we have now products that are used that are not necessarily safe? I don't know how we're overlooking that.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, our rules state that you have to comply with local codes and ordinances, and the city on a salon license, the city has to come and sign off that you are up to codes. Now, we don't ask for that on a renewal, so if a nail salon has been there for 15 years, they can renew their license. We have it in our rules that you have to apply, be current with the current city codes. But yes, there's definitely some very harsh chemicals, especially used in nail salons. But to address your concerns specifically, is there a air quality code in our rules or laws? Not at this time.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Mulroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I'm the only one that doesn't understand. What's the difference between getting a haircut from a barber or from a cosmetologist, and who can do what, and can the barber do nails and all
that?
Yeah.
$50. Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm not a licensed cosmetologist or a barber, so but barbers can shave, and they can do, the biggest difference is barbers can shave. Now, barbers can perm and I believe do color, but cosmetologists, the cosmetology license oversees hair, cutting of the hair, coloring it, your skin, like doing pedicures, doing a facial, putting these, like, think of it like sugar water. I mean, it's not that. I'm trying to simplify, and they put it on your face and makes you feel good and might make you think you have less wrinkles and... and then they can paint your nails. They can paint your toenails. They can paint your fingernails. And but there's a difference.
I think I'm going to get.
Why have you tried it,
Representative Mulroy? I think maybe you should try it.
Yeah. Well, Representative Mahoney has, so he was recommending it.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an enlightening presentation for 24 hours. You did great.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much.
And members, I think we're going to try to see if we can get housing department to come in and give testimony next Tuesday, and maybe the barbers.
Yeah.
So with that, I'd like to make one announcement. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do know that the, and I told this to you, and I think that the barber director's out on leave right now.
Okay, we'll find somebody else.
Couple weeks.
We'll give somebody more than 24-hour notice, or try to. I got one more announcement. This is the last meeting that Representative Sertich is going to be here, and I've known Representative Sertich for, what, 10 years? 15 years. Boy, that's really. And he was an L.A. for Senator Janicich when I first met him, and we have become very, very close friends. In fact, he's about the only person here that I would call an honorary nephew. So I am going to miss him from this side of the table. However, I want you all to know, look up the IRRB, figure out some very difficult questions, because he's going to be the new commissioner, and we're looking forward to having him here.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much, and I consider you a very close friend, and thank you. I'm going to have more to say about you in about an hour, so I'm not going to bore the committee with hearing it twice, but I'm looking forward to this new opportunity, and as Commissioner Peterson showed today that we're going to have a very open administration, and I'm at your beck and call. Though please give me a little heads up, because my office is actually located up in Eveleth on the Iron Range, 3 hours away from here. So when you need me, I'll come back. I'll be here whenever you need me, but just give me a little notice, because I got to jump in the car. But I look forward
to... You don't have that plane?
We don't have a plane. But Mr. Chair and members, for those that know me, I thank you for your well wishes in the past few days, and for those that I don't know, because there's a lot of new members sitting on this committee, I look forward to getting to know you and being as accessible as possible to this agency that's been around for 70 years. But two things: nobody knows what to call it, and many people outside of the Iron Range don't know what it does. So I look forward to the opportunity to educate and be available to all of you.
And with that, members, this meeting is adjourned.
I thank you.